This is Counter Stories, a podcast by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Don Eubanks, Associate Professor and Cultural Consultant.
I'm Halee Lee, owner of the Other Media Group.
Luz Maria Frias, CEO and founder of The Savvy Coach.
I'm Marianne Combs, recorder and producer for Minnesota Public Radio News. And we're joined this week by a special guest who's sitting in for Anthony Galloway, Akua Ellis. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm Akua Ellis, Senior Vice President of Community Impact for the Greater Twin Cities United Way.
Well, welcome, Akua, and welcome, everyone. I think one of the things that we all agreed that we wanted to examine and explore was to kind of reach a little bit deeper beyond a lot of the rhetoric and conversations that many of us have been having on social media and with friends and acquaintances around all the events around us as a result of George Floyd's death, the subsequent unrest, the ongoing push from communities of color, African American and other communities to look at and examine systemic change as it deals with racism in this country. And so I think that today we're just going to kind of dive a little bit deeper into that and pull some of these things out. So
I start with just the narrative that we continue to hear on mainstream media about there are only a few bad apples in the police department, and that this is what we're seeing nationally is not indicative of police practices, and that these are the exceptions and not the rules. And my issue with that, when we look at where police are, there's a lack of national policing standards. There's a lack of national training criteria and accreditation. There are about 18,000 police departments across our country, and they're all operating independently. Even though they're operating independently, this culture of brutality and excessive force still is pervasive. And what's been triggering for me in the last couple of days is a memory that I had suppressed that is at least 30 years old. I grew up inner city Chicago in the Barrio, which is an under-resourced but yet over-policed neighborhood. And I remember with clarity, I'm 20 years old. On a Saturday morning, I worked at a bank. I was an assistant supervisor. And I get in my car and I see a police car heading the opposite direction of where I am traveling. I made a mental notation. It didn't really startle me at that point. But as soon as I came out of my parking spot and started to proceed, that police car then did a U-turn and proceeded to follow me. And I thought to myself, okay, just drive carefully, you know, make sure you come to a full stop and nothing will happen. And these officers then started sexually harassing me as I'm driving. It was a summer day, and they pull up to the left of me facing ongoing traffic, right? So against traffic, and they start sexually harassing me through the window that is open and asking me to pull over so that they get to know me better. And I'm having a hard time telling the story because it's triggering for me. I worked about 2 miles from where I lived, so I kept thinking to myself, just keep going straight and you'll be safe as soon as you get to the bank where you work. So I'm driving and they continued to do this the entire time, and then they started saying it over their microphone, their PA system, and I'm becoming at that point really, really scared and nervous about my personal safety. It's 7:45 in the morning on a Saturday, and there isn't much traffic to be seen, and I am starting to really panic, and this is before cell phones, so I'm dating myself. So I decided to pull into the customer parking lot, which we were told by management, if we ever parked there, we would risk losing our jobs. But it was a decision for me to either preserve my personal safety or keep my job. And I intentionally parked right in front of the drive-through windows, which is, as you know, it's almost an entire wall of windows. And I thought, if something's going to happen, hopefully someone will see me. And I parked my car there, and I literally ran to the front door, which was locked because the bank didn't open until another 15, 20 minutes. And as I did that, the squad stopped right in front of the bank door and proceeded to continue to sexually harass me. The security officers for the bank were all off-duty officers, three of them. And I'd been working at the bank for 3 years already, so they knew me. So I'm running to the door with the keys in hand, and then I get to the door, and I'm loudly knocking on the window of the bank so that they can let me in. One of the security officers for the bank opened the door and saw my face. By this point, I'm crying. And he at the same time looked to see the squad. And by then, I had really made a mental note of the squad number. I proceeded to then tell him what was happening, and he grew furious, and he was very understanding, but at the same time, he told the other security guards that didn't surprise him because he was well aware of their conduct. And I share that because it was extremely difficult for me living through that period in time. It was very typical in my neighborhood for women to be sexually harassed by police officers. And I guess I hadn't realized how I had suppressed that memory as long as I did for the 30 years or so. And it wasn't until I was reflecting on what we were going to be talking about this morning. I guess what I want to say to our audience is, this is not an exception. This is what we see in our communities that are over-policed. I was listening to Nicole Hannah-Jones last week when she was doing her interview on structural racism with Oprah. And one statement that she made was, in communities of color, we want to have police departments the way white communities have, meaning those police officers in well-resourced white communities are not faced with these types of terroristic behaviors. But us living in communities of color that are under-resourced financially and are over-policed experience these on a daily basis. And I have so many examples of how my friends, male friends, teenagers would be walking down the street doing nothing other than walking and police officers coming to a screeching halt, grabbing them by the shirt collar and throwing them up against a brick building and harassing them because they could. And those are the realities of what we have faced in our communities of color, our Black communities, our Indigenous communities, our Mexican communities, the list goes on and on. And this is what we have to carry for the rest of our lives. We have to carry that trauma and the triggers that we see every time we see someone being killed or mistreated by police. We are triggered by those memories.
Luz, thank you so much for sharing. It doesn't only happen in urban settings either. I'll share a short story. My husband is an older white gentleman. As my counselor's family knows, we have a 25-year age difference. We like to go fishing. We like to go camping. And we were up north, northern Minnesota, in Deer River, Minnesota. And they were having Wild Rice Days. And so we decided we were going to stop at Wild Rice Days. And they were selling cranberry vodkas for $1.50. So I had a little bit, a lot to drink. And it was the middle of summer, and I tanned very easily, and people kept mistaking me for an Indigenous woman. And I also wear my hair in braids a lot. And so people kept mistaking me for an Indigenous woman. Well, at the end of the night, my husband and I are like, let's go back to the hotel we were staying at in Grand Rapids. Immediately, we get pulled over. The cops said we pulled out of our parking spot too quickly. I'm pretty much passed out, 25 years younger than my white husband. The cop looks at me and says, where are you going? And my husband says, I'm going back to the hotel. And we're let go without question. And I remember kind of the next morning, like, did that really happen? No one was concerned for my safety. He was never asked for his license or anything. It was just, oh, okay. Well, you know, you pulled out of that spot really quick. And that was it. These are real fears. And I've heard this, you know, we've been having conversations with neighbors and stuff, and people say, does those things really happen? That might have happened once, or that might have been your one-time experience, or, you know, my fear for my brothers when they're out driving. There was a time when there were helicopters all over, and they're looking for an Asian guy with a certain build and a certain age. And that really was the only description that was given. And I remember everyone calling up my brothers and saying, stay home. Don't go anywhere if you fit this description. Because the only description is an Asian male, you know, between the ages of 20 and 30. These are scary things that I think people think that everyone has a story and then that's it. And that it doesn't happen that often. Hopefully people start to realize that that's not the case, that there really is a systemic issue. And that these stories, you know, as painful it is for us to tell, are things that people need to hear.
I think the narrative that, you know, all of us are addressing is this narrative that it's just a few bad apples that, you know, for the most part, I mean, you know, close white friends of mine posted that, you know, all his interactions with police department, the police have been professional and have been this and have been that. This was a few years in North Minneapolis at my sister's apartment off Golden Valley Road, and her brother-in-law was there. He didn't have a car, so I offered to take him to the store to pick something up. So we hopped in my car, we pulled out of the parking lot right on Golden Valley Road, and much like your experience, Luz, a squad car drove by us, and when I looked in my rearview mirror, I saw that squad car whip a U-turn. And when you see a squad car whip a U-turn, you know you're going to get pulled over. And sure enough, this guy comes screeching behind me, pulls me over, gets us out of the car, and within a minute, there were four other squad cars there. All these cops hop out of their squad cars with their guns drawn. They literally pulled their guns out on me and my sister's brother-in-law. Were up against the car. They told me to assume the position. I wasn't sure what they meant by that because I'd never been arrested. So I asked them, what position is that? They thought I was, you know, being sarcastic and got mad at me. So they pushed me against the car, told me to put my hands on the car and then spread my legs. They patted me down. In the meantime, they're going through my car. I'm asking them, you know, what the hell is going on? Because I'm scared to death. I've got like 10 guns pointed at me and my sister's brother-in-law. All of a sudden, another cop walks up and begins to talk to them. And just like that, they put their guns away and they started retreating to their cars and begin to drive off. So I asked one of the remaining cops that was there what this was all about. And his response was, they had gotten a call over the radio that two black guys had been breaking into cars, stealing car radios, and one of them had on a gray top. I had on a gray sweatshirt. I looked at him and I asked him, if you were in Edina and you got a call of two white boys breaking into cars, and one of them had on a gray top, would you pull over every two white boys you saw that had on a gray tops? And the guy just looked at me, did not say a word, and hopped in his car and drove off. Those are just examples that I can share with you of how, as a male of color in the Twin Cities, how differently we are treated by the police. I mean, these episodes leave traumatic experiences with us. To this day, I'm 65 years old. I'm an associate professor at Metropolitan State, and my blood pressure goes up every time a squad car drives by me because I don't know what's going to happen.
And it doesn't matter how much education you have or what your title is, you're still subjected to that. And the fact that those experiences are maybe not specifically replicated, but some semblance of connection across this country, across different spectrums of difference within communities of color, is what is coming to a head in this moment. We're not afforded the luxury of being individuals, either in how we're treated by officers or how our interactions with officers, once they come to light, are perceived by the general public. Yet whenever an officer has misbehaved, you know, we are required, asked, expected to consider that officer or those officers as just a few bad actors. when the consistent theme in all those stories is people of color and law enforcement.
I'm really struck by this moment and where we are in a pattern that repeats itself, and how we are talking about these incidences with police, and we're in the midst of reckoning with a high-profile incident with police in the killing of George Floyd, and yet there are still others that are continuing to happen. And the sense of this time it's different. There is all this tension around this moment saying, hey, people are noticing this time and changes are happening this time. But it feels like this moment is pivotal in terms of whether we make progress and move forward or whether the pattern repeats itself and that we go back into this sort of complacency that we've experienced in the past, whether it was Philando Castile or Jamar Clark, Trayvon Martin, any of those people. There was a protest and then things quieted down and went back to status quo. I guess it's so interesting to me to figure out, like, what makes this different and how do we contain or continue this momentum moving forward so that it isn't just another pattern, another cycle, and an unending series of cycles.
It feels different to me, Marianne. And I don't think you can be in the space of working with community and not be an eternal optimist. But I will tell you that part of what gives me some pause is the recognition that this won't actually be different, that we won't actually realize the potential of this moment for lasting change if white folks don't sustain their energy and their calls for change. These calls for justice, for change, for policy reform, they're not new in communities of color. It's going to take a consistent, concerted effort among white people to sustain this energy. That's a hard truth because I want to have faith. You know, I do have faith. And then, you know, history and time give me pause.
What comes to my mind, and I agree with you, is if we were to distill this to what really is at issue, it's power. It's who has the power in our country as it pertains to the systems that are being developed, as to the laws that support the systems. And there is a real necessity for us to ensure that those who are in power are willing to understand their role in being a part of the solution. What we're seeing with the unrest is a cry for urgency, that these promises that we keep hearing back and forth over the course of time, they've not been kept. They've been broken. I look at you, Don, and I look at the indigenous community and all the treaties that were broken. What I am also encouraged by, because I'm also an incurable optimist, is the racial makeup of those who are in the streets sharing the pain with communities of color and indigenous people, meaning our folks from the dominant white society. And at the same time, my red flag comes up because we know that in the past, when there has been this joining of forces, that those in power are quickly coming in to figure out a way to divide us, right? That divide and conquer and not allow us joining forces. There is a very sinister approach to make sure that we don't continue to have this coalition of people working together. And that's the one part of history that I'm hoping that we can change, and that we won't let that divide and conquer strategy come in.
Part of the other thing that I've been kind of experiencing and feeling day in and day out as we kind of move through this cycle, I was trying to think of a term to call it. I think maybe one way I could describe this, these microaggressions I get as I listen to mainstream media begin to change their messaging in terms of how this country is steadily moving to move back to some kind of getting back to normal. And then tying it back to what you just said, Luz, in terms of power, it's like how news is covering now the debate that's happening in Congress. Mitch McConnell just came out and said that, you know, the House, which is controlled by Democrats. So on mainstream media, this is framed within two political parties. The Democrats are putting together their language to address reforming police, making changes. They're hearing Black Lives Matter from other voices screaming out in the United States. And then you have the Senate, who's controlled by Republicans, are putting their language together, which is offering, in my mind, much less toward reforming police. And Mitch McConnell's response to what's coming out of the Democrats is that once that reaches the Senate, it's dead on arrival.
You know, there are a host of bills and policy ideas that have been posited by the Posse Caucus, the People of Color Indigenous Caucus. And those are not ideas that are brand new. They're things that have come from community, been vetted through series of kind of policy study groups, and have passed through many of them through the House and have been dead on arrival in the Senate. And I'll bring it back to this. But one of the pieces in what Luz shared earlier that has me thinking about this is, you know, I don't always feel like the attempts made by those in power, or like, quote unquote, the establishment, is intentionally to placate. Although that is certainly in some cases, for sure. I don't want to be naive about that. What I do think happens in some instances is a lack of understanding of the depth of need and history that folks are trying to undo. And so you might take some measure that feels good or that you think addresses a need or a hurt that is on the surface because you don't understand how deep it goes. And so what I'm observing in the conversation at our Senate is a lack of curiosity and or empathy for experiences that may be outside of those leaders' day-to-day lives. Just because you don't experience it, just because it isn't real in central Minnesota, for example, doesn't mean that it's not a challenge and doesn't mean that we don't, as a collective state, benefit from making those changes. You know, whenever I see, it doesn't show up on my timeline, but I might be scrolling through my cousin's timelines and, you know, they live in more rural areas. And if they have taken a position on social media about police brutality, you know, there's inevitably one of their white friends will chime in and say, well, you know, white people get killed by the police too. And what if we protested every single time that happened? I'm like, no, like, let's think that through. What would happen if you protested every single time someone was killed by the cops? What do you think would happen if there was a joint stand for consistent law enforcement application? If there was a joint call for looking at law enforcement in a different light, looking at law enforcement as one of an array of tools available to ensure safety and well-being? What if you demanded that? Now take that same energy and take it to the Capitol, like right now, right now.
You're listening to Counter Stories on Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Marianne Combs, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Donald Eubanks, Lee Lee, and Luz Maria Frias. And our special guest this week is Akua Ellis with Greater Twin Cities United Way. We'll get right back to the conversation, but first, it's time for a break for news headlines. We're back. You're listening to Counter Stories. I'm Marianne Combs, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Halee Lee, Donald Eubanks, and Luz Maria Frias. Our special guest this week is Akua Ellis with Greater Twin Cities United Way. And Akua, I'd really love to hear your thoughts on this moment as to what we need to keep that motivation, to keep people interested and pushing, because you were saying earlier that white people need to take ownership of this movement if there's going to be a real change. How do you move all of that forward and keep people focused on this moment?
It's a huge question. I honestly feel like what is required is curiosity. So if we talk just from a media perspective, we need to have more reporters who are understanding or getting to the heart of long-standing trends that people are bucking. This moment has been building for centuries. This is an unrest that is being felt across the world because for too long, people have been oppressed systemically. And so there's an opportunity for media to be curious about how that's shown up in people's day-to-day lives. You know, what are the systems in play? So there's a heightened interest right now around the notion of systemic oppression, but very little understanding. You know, the more that mainstream media can get to those underlying questions and those themes and those practices that have led to what people are rebelling against and has, you know, been ingrained in the fabric of our country, I think that will help, because right now it feels like a huge game of he said, she said. You know, there's the experiences of people of color who are, you know, bringing them to the surface. And then there are people who have never experienced those incredibly difficult times with law enforcement or with other kind of bodies of power, who have a hard time understanding and believing. There's a lack of curiosity or a need for more curiosity among media and other storytellers, important storytellers. There's a lack of curiosity I have found even among folks who would consider themselves woke. You know, I think there's such a thing as being too woke, where you're taking your awareness and absent empathy, you're weaponizing it. You know, so being curious about where someone else is coming from, curious about what might be informing their point of view. We released a statement, you know, everybody's making a statement about how they feel about the murder of George Floyd and how they're going to respond. And, you know, United Way is not an exception. You know, there were folks who took issue with some of the framing of our language. And so, you know, we're not unique in that way. I'm sure every person who's leading publicly that had a statement had factions of their teams that were disappointed with the way they approached that. And yet what was absent for me in some of what I was hearing was a desire to understand what informed where we landed. A desire to be curious about the progress that has been made even in the last year. You know, I think that we are so quick to want to act that it preempts our ability to just pause and think critically and be curious about each other's perspectives. You know, so there's an opportunity there. You know, and then I would say among policymakers, there's a tremendous need to be curious about the lived experiences of people whose lives and whose perspectives don't match your own. Because the absence of that means stalled legislation that is informed by community, informed by the very people who are aligned with not only the experiences, but the solutions to get at real lasting change. But it's being ignored because we have policymakers that lack curiosity about what that might look like, about the possibility that someone could have a different experience than their own or than anybody in their immediate kind of sphere of influence. And so there's an absence of curiosity there. And how it is showing up is an absence of progress and perhaps the loss of this moment. I get so riled up about it. We're on the precipice of something phenomenal and powerful. And at the same time, we find ourselves hamstrung by a lack of imagination and curiosity and empathy. And like that is just completely untenable to me. And yeah, I think curiosity.
Akua, for me, I agree. And I want to also underscore the importance that policymakers and everyone else in our community, in whatever leadership role and the role that they are playing to grow and understand this journey for themselves, who might be from the dominant society, the white, you know, the white community, that we can't continue to think on this binary mindset that it's either or, either your experience or my experience. And my experience as a white person, I don't have that. So it's, you know, by that experience, then I'm invalidating yours. We need folks to move from that point and understand it as a both and situation, right? Both of these can be true at the very same time. That you as a white person who might be 55 years old or 69 years old, and you've never had a brush with police brutality, excessive force, or any type of intimidation by police, does not invalidate all these experiences that are occurring and are being shared painfully, painfully. No one wants to keep reliving these triggering moments. We are asking others who have not had those experiences to listen, to understand. Listen with an open mind that these can both, and in fact are both, true at the same time. It's a both and situation. Because you've not had the experience does not mean that you can invalidate everyone else's experience. And I hope that people really understand that importance to change and shift their mindset, because without that, my fear is that we're not going to be able to make the progress that we critically need to make.
I think you're absolutely right, Luz. And, you know, the piece that, as I had a moment to reflect and listen to you, that is coming up for me that accompanies that need for curiosity is also courage. And so I think much of what we're experiencing and seeing among folks who would continue to resist this uprising is the courage to face what might be an uncomfortable truth or something that would require them to do something outside of what they know. So doing things differently, showing up differently, learning, challenging, you know, their experience relative to someone else's, like all of that, and actually doing something different, all of that in many instances requires courage.
I think it's interesting, though, and this is the point where I get stuck, is I'm trying to imagine people who up until now have not shown that curiosity, courage, imagination, and empathy, and saying to myself, how do we make that change? Are people capable of transforming?
I think so. I believe so, but it takes personal relationships in many instances. I'm sorry, Halee.
I'm just saying, I agree. I've said this on the last show, I've said this. I think we're all constantly evolving. I think a lot of white people who are starting to just realize that this is happening, I think instead of what I've seen a lot of is it's too late to be awoken. I don't think it's too late to wake up. And I think that when we have white neighbors, my husband and I sit outside on our front patio a lot, so we get a lot of people walk by, and you try to have those conversations with people and you try to educate them, and you really, sometimes you really do see it like a light bulb in their brain of like, oh my God, really? This really does happen? This is a thing? You know, and I think the most important thing is as we gather allies to the cause is to not say, you should have woken up 10 years ago, but say, okay, you're awake now. Now join us. Like you said, there's a lot of emotion and it's hard for people to say, okay, now join us, when they want to say, where were you 10 years ago? But I think that's where the emotion and the learning.
That's coming from pain, clearly. You know, people who have been in pain for so long, for generations, and expressing that pain in that way. But again, you know, I go back to, it's a both and situation. You can be in that pain, and part of that healing is inviting others to be part of the solution and be a part of this movement so that we can effectuate the change that we need so that our children and our grandchildren and future generations are not experiencing what we have had to live through.
So maybe there's a third C. So there's curiosity, courage, compassion. You know, there's a woman that I work with, Olivia Jefferson, who's always mindful to remind us, especially in conversations around equity, to call people in. You know, I think the tendency to call out, when I have the presence of mind to pause and be patient and demonstrate empathy, even in service to folks whose actions or words might irritate me, which, you know, that happens more often than not right now. But even in the instance that I just shared about work, when I just paused and just gave myself the time and space to think compassionately, to channel compassion in response to that, what came up for me is, you know, there are folks who are so emotionally invested in the work and want to see us show up optimally and see that we have an important role to play and an important platform to leverage. But again, absent that curiosity and compassion, it shows up in a way that is counterproductive, or it can show up in a way that is counterproductive if we aren't all mindful to just take a breath and demonstrate compassion.
That's beautiful. I love the idea of the compassion. And Halee, you've talked so eloquently about the emotions that are running high. And I do think that, you know, we have a culture right now that's, for a lot of reasons, people are used to being in the position of criticizing. They're not in a position to build or have power. And I'm wondering, you know, again, as I think about the pivotal nature of this movement moving forward, how do we empower those people who have been in positions to criticize the people in power so that they can step into positions where they are able to create and build and have a voice in something new? that they are welcomed into a space where those ideas that they've had, that they've been sitting on or been frustrated that they couldn't do anything with, are actually going to grow.
I feel like that is a great tie back to the point that Luz made earlier around listening to experiences that may be different from yours and providing the space, like intentionally seeking those perspectives and then honoring that both can be true.
You know, when we think about that, that really underscores in my mind the need for organizations, whether it is a nonprofit, a for-profit, government, what have you, for our organizations to reflect the demographics and diversity of our communities. Because with diversity of people comes diversity of thought. There's a saying, and I'm going to say it in Spanish and I'll translate it to you, but a saying that my mom would always tell us, cada cabeza es un mundo, which means every mind is a universe of knowledge in and of itself. It's a body of experiences that you can always learn from when you engage with somebody else. So I offer that up as yet another incentive for organizations to embrace bringing in people of color, indigenous people, into their workforce strategically, into their C-suite, which is so critical, into the board. And there might be an argument that, well, you know, we don't have any open board positions. Well, maybe as a board chair, you offer up the invitation to board members who can resign from their terms early to make room for others. We saw Serena Williams' husband do that, right? It was very much a big part of a message that he drove that he was stepping aside to specifically make room for an African-American board member to join that board. And I'm talking about Reddit. This is the moment where leaders in the business community and across our nation need to think outside the box, need to have courage, to go back to Akua's point earlier, to do things they're uncomfortable with or to try things they've never done, to think outside the box with the lens of how can I be a part of the solution? Because each one of us has a role to be a part of the solution, professionally, personally, socially, right? We have to ask ourselves, what is with my sphere of influence that will allow us to change? I was part of a conversation just a week ago with a bunch of leaders where there was a certain recommendation about their capacity. The response was, well, you know, that's not really what we do. And I challenged the conversation and said, it may not be what you do, but do you agree that it's within your sphere of influence to be able to leverage your role as a community leader and presence to then effectuate this change? We need to not be set in our mindset to say it only looks one way, the way that we've always done, because that's the definition of insanity, right? Albert Einstein. We keep doing the same things and expect a different result. This is why we are still where we are more than 50 years after the Civil Rights Act has passed. We can't afford to do that anymore. And there isn't the patience anymore, quite honestly.
But Luz, I would love to hear from each of you about this. And I'm sure some of you have had this experience, or at least one of you have this experience of being the person who's asked to be the token diversity representative on a board. I mean, and that's the thing that I feel like we need to move past, is that people get hired, or you're asked to be on a board or hired to a job, and it's all the weight of diverse representation falls on them and the optics around them being there. But when it comes to actually valuing the diversity that they bring to the table, it's just like you're running up against a brick wall. So how do we break through that? I mean, it seems like we can't just have the one or two board positions. It needs to be, you know, at least 50-50, that you are have multiple people, multiple different perspectives coming to the board or coming to into an organization to truly move the needle so that there's actually a difference in terms of the ideas that are being generated and the actions that are taken.
The cardinal rule when I work with organizations in helping them with their board and their leadership is we cannot have any onlys, because when you have an only, you're setting the folks up to fail, and the diversity of thought is no longer one that is being set up in a collective way, right? It is always the other. And so it just further otherizes, as Professor John Powell out in Berkeley says, further otherizes people of color and their thought thinking. So to some degree, you're setting them up for failure, right? And not being able to have that courage and leverage their voice in a way that is to be effective. So that's the cardinal rule. And I agree with you, Marianne, and what that formula is, it's got to be, you know, 30 to 40%, 50%, whatever it is, but it cannot be just the one. We have organizations in our community in Minnesota, and I'll call out Nexus Community Partners, that has a boards and commission training program for people of color, indigenous people, and they train people to be on boards and commissions, how to read the financial statements, how to read the audit, and so on and so forth. In terms of professionals in our community here in the Twin Cities, there are plenty of organizations of attorneys of color, indigenous attorneys. We have all of them in town. Accountants, MBAs, physicians, engineers, the list goes on and on. We do have a bench that has the capacity to serve on these boards and be able to effectuate the change with their thought leadership and their background that would be a part of this. The difficulty, though, is that those systemic barriers remain in place, where there's a default line of thinking that board members who are currently on the board will recruit other board members. And if you have a dominant white board, then it'll continue to perpetuate itself, right? So there are some boards that are being more proactive and seeking out consultants that will help them recruit board members and candidates from communities of color and indigenous communities. And that is one way to disrupt the practice that they've long held on to or have observed. But I, with every conviction of my body, refuse to believe that there are not enough of us as people of color, indigenous people, who are qualified to be able to step in. We are there. It's just we need the doors to get opened and allow us then to be a part of it. The statistics nationally about how many board members in the private sector and corporate sectors who are Black are single digits, who are Latinos are even half of that, who are Indigenous is going to be even a portion, a fraction of that, goes on. And we need to embed that diversity of thought into these leadership positions. That's the inside game, right? The outside game is happening in the streets with the uprising. The inside game also needs to happen.
I think it's so interesting that we've gone from police violence to diversity on boards, because I feel like we are actually mimicking like the process that needs to happen.
Yes.
Right now, this is it. We have the battle on the street, and then it needs to come in and flow up to the top of the organizations. And I just want to say that I think I had a really great thought, you guys. It was so good.
Can I address the battle on the street?
So the battle on the street and the battle from within, I've had a little bit of a struggle, because when I've, you know, agree to work with large white corporations or organizations on a project or something, I get called out as selling out. And I think that's another issue of this infighting. It's like, you know, it's hard. I run a business and we have a very specific goal. And sometimes, you know, I feel like maybe I can make more change when I'm working from the inside of an organization or from out of a project. And then those who are out on the street doing the work then calls me, and, you know, a sellout. And I think that's a hard thing, another emotional thing, but a hard thing that for folks to walk that line and between both worlds at that point.
I think what's really interesting is that, you know, this conversation has mimicked sort of the process that needs to happen. And I know we talked about frustrations with this not happening before now, and, you know, what real change can happen. And I just think that it's so important to recognize that because of COVID, we are changing the way we're doing so many things, that things are on the table, how we work, the way we show up at our jobs, the way we make money. They're all going through systemic change right now. So actually, what better moment for this change to happen? It feels like there's a lot more wiggle room than there might have been in the past because so much is in flux right now. Does that make sense?
I love that. I love that. And I would say, Halit, to your frustration of being called out, people need to understand, again, it's a both and situation, and that we need the outside game. We need those folks being disruptors of what our thoughts have been in the past and participating in the uprising so that the inside game can be responsive. And when you think about the systems, that is so true with public policy. How do public policy leaders, elected leaders, often work and are geared by hearing from their constituencies, right? We need both of these voices and movements to work in tandem together. And it's not being a sellout, it's being strategic. It's being strategic to know that we have to have both of these strategies working in tandem, an outside game and an inside game to effectuate the change.
Marianne, I really liked the comments you made just a few minutes ago in terms of kind of capitalizing what our discussion has been about in this episode of Counter Stories. And I think that, you know, before we leave, that it would be ill of us as Counter Stories, not to mention that, you know, this coming weekend is Juneteenth, and the celebration of when slaves were notified that they were free down in Texas. And of course, we all are aware that this happened years after actual speech given by Lincoln, his Emancipation Proclamation, when it took 2-3 years for this message to make it to Texas. And so there are Juneteenth celebrations coming up. I hope that as communities that you can go out and support this effort. I've also heard that there are corporations, I think Target is letting at least their corporate office off on Juneteenth, and that others are pushing to have this recognized as a legitimate national holiday. Please go out and enjoy Juneteenth activities in your communities. I encourage people to take part in Juneteenth celebrations in the safest possible manner, whether that's virtually or offering support or donations, but be safe. You've been listening to Counter Stories. I'm Don Eubanks, Associate Professor, Metropolitan State University.
Ali Lee, owner of the Other Media Group.
Luz Maria Frias, founder and CEO of The Savvy Coach.
Marianne Combs, reporter and producer with NPR News. And we have Akua.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm Akua Ellis, Senior Vice President of Community Impact for the Greater Twin Cities United Way.
Thanks for listening.